Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People, we bring you a report on Pope Francis's Angelus address on the Feast of the Assumption, where he entrusted to Mary the anxieties and sorrows of the many people suffering from natural disasters, social tensions, and conflicts. The evils of racism. U.S. Cardinal Daniel DiNardo speaks to us about the deadly clashes in Charlottesville, Virginia, saying the violence is an attempt to divide the nation. Risking one's life in humanitarian service. August the 19th is World Humanitarian Day that pays tribute to aid workers who help millions of people around the world. And Popes, Water and Rome. We delve back into the history of Rome and discover the key role past popes played in helping to ensure a constant flow of fresh, clean water through the aqueducts and fountains of the Eternal City. We begin the programme with a report on Pope Francis's reflections during his Angelus address for the Feast of the Assumption on August the 15th. Addressing the thousands of pilgrims present in St. Peter's Square, the Pope said God is able to do great things through those who are poor and humble, but who have faith, like Mary did.
In his remarks, Pope Francis reflected on the Gospel reading, which relates the meeting of Mary with Elizabeth, and records Mary's triumphant song of praise, the Magnificat.
Il dono più grande che Maria porta a Elisabetta e al mondo intero è Gesù.
The greatest gift that Mary brings to Elizabeth, the Pope said, is Jesus, who already lives within her, not in faith and hope as in so many women in the Old Testament. Rather, Jesus has taken human flesh from the Virgin for his mission of salvation. Elizabeth, the Pope said, had already received the joy of pregnancy after having felt for so long the sorrow of not having a baby.
E quando arriva Maria, la gioia trabocca.
Now, at the arrival of Mary, her joy overflows and bursts from her heart because the invisible but real presence of Jesus fills her senses. That joy is echoed by Mary in the Magnificat, a song of praise for God, who accomplishes his plan of salvation through the poor and the humble. In the house of Elizabeth and her husband Zechariah, the Pope continued, the coming of Jesus through Mary creates not only a climate of joy and fraternal communion, but also a climate of faith that leads to hope, to prayer, to praise. And we too, Pope Francis continued, desire these things for our own homes.
Celebrando Maria Santissima assunta in cielo, vorremmo che lei...
Celebrating Mary Most Holy, assumed into heaven, he said, we would like her once more to bring to us, to our families, to our communities, that immense gift, that unique grace that we must always seek first and above all other graces that we have at heart, the grace that is Jesus Christ.
Maria è modello di virtù e di fede.
Mary, the Pope said, in conclusion, is the model of virtue and of faith. In contemplating her today, assumed into heaven, at the final completion of her earthly journey, we give thanks that she always goes before us in the pilgrimage of life and of faith. And, he said, we ask that she protect and sustain us, that we might have a strong, joyful, and merciful faith, that she might help us to be saints, to meet together with her one day in paradise. Following the Angelus, Pope Francis entrusted to Mary, as Queen of Peace, the anxieties and sorrows of peoples who, in many parts of the world, are suffering on account of natural calamities, of social tensions, or of conflicts. He prayed, may our Heavenly Mother obtain consolation for all and a future of serenity and of concord. I'm Christopher Wells.
Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Turning to the US amid the continuing fallout following the deadly clashes between white supremacist groups and protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12th, the Catholic Church has been among those speaking out against the violence. Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, condemned what he called the evils of racism and neo-Nazism on display in Charlottesville and described the violence as an attempt to divide the nation. He spoke to Christopher Wells about the church's reaction.
I issued a statement on behalf of all of the bishops of the United States and what seemed to be also joining a number of leaders, religious and otherwise, around the nation, condemning the abhorrent acts of violence, hatred that were on display in Charlottesville. We see it as an attack on the unity of our nation. We see it as a massive evil thing. I would be want to say that we find all of those racism, white supremacy, neo-Nazism evils have raised their voices in acts of deplorable violence, and so we want to raise our voices against them. May I add, we also want to pray for the victims of violence, especially for the young woman, Heather Heyer, and her family. Our point is to pray, to call on Catholics and all peoples of goodwill to pray for healing, and then to start working anew for unity and peace in this time of tension and division.
Your Eminence, the Church has been part of the conversation on race and peace and unity in our country. The events in Charlottesville seem to be part of a series of events that have inflamed racial tensions and other divisions in the United States. Can you kind of clarify some of the issues that are being raised by these events? What's at the heart of these new racial tensions, these new divisions in the country?
Well, we last year, in light of earlier racially charged shootings and whatnot in the country, had put together a task force to promote peace in our communities. And we did that last year with a series of recommendations for calling Catholics together too, even with others, and to speak a little more on this mutual respect. What we find that's newer now is that what would be just voices now are descending into actions, and actions of violence and against African Americans, people of color. By the way, we've also noted some in some of the more recent things, anti-Semitic comments too. For some, the emphasis on our nation, and as you know, we've had nationalisms before that have been hurtful, but now we see this rising again, along with this racist thinking and action. We see that as new, even though this has happened before, but we see it as new and therefore calls for a response by people of goodwill, by religious people. I think it calls for a response by our own Catholic congregations.
And in fact, you've just denounced this atmosphere of hatred and division in very strong terms. What can the Church as a whole and Catholics as individuals do in terms of peaceful action and concrete actions aimed at building up peace?
One thing to do, of course, is to pray constantly and consistently about these issues and pray for any conversion in our own hearts that may lend ourselves to certain kinds of stereotypical thinking or lead ourselves to think that any kind of action can be justified that hurts or causes violence to another. I believe that the Catholic communities themselves can work in their parishes for welcoming, particularly in terms of our African-American community. But we can also do welcoming in our community by speaking up on the issues. I think that where a small group of hate is met consistently by, I think, the larger numbers of people in our country and in our church who are certainly opposed to that kind of racism and nationalistic baiting, that's a presence. Part of the problem of any kind of evil getting a foothold is when the really good people don't say anything. So I think that's part of it. So those kinds of issues are important, that we speak, that we act together. For some, it may be prayer services. For some, it may be some joint action in a city. Those are the kinds of things where those of goodwill who peacefully come together to pray and advocate in behalf of all those who are tinged by this racist thinking.
And any final thoughts as we wrap up our interview?
Well, I think what we are is at the beginning of another form of both encouragement and action that we, I think, as bishops will do and will be speaking about very soon, that has happened before in our country. Chris, it is unfortunate that the history of racism has been a blot on our country almost since its inception. And we have moments and times where we do well. I certainly think over the past 40 years there have been many good things that have happened. But it is obvious from the kinds of things that went on this weekend that we still have work to do. So it just reminds us that this is a steady task.
Make me an instrument of your peace.
And that was Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of Galveston, Houston, interviewed by Christopher Wells.
Forgive when my brother's crying. Let me bring comfort. In your love may I always live.
World Humanitarian Day is celebrated each year on August the 19th and pays tribute to aid workers who often risk their own lives to bring help to millions of people across the globe. The day is also to rally support for people affected by crises around the world. Michael O'Riordan is the Emergency Programme Manager in South Sudan for the Catholic Aid Agency for England and Wales, CAFOD, and its Irish counterpart, Trocara. He's been based in South Sudan since earlier this year, when the first news of a famine in the war-torn country emerged. He told me that although the famine has since been largely pushed back, thanks to humanitarian aid, the people there are still facing starvation and hunger, and the threat of a new famine has not receded.
Unfortunately, the threat is very much still there, but across the whole country, the level of food insecurity actually increased with very significant numbers of the population really relying on the humanitarian aid coming in from the very different aid agencies.
In some of the worst affected areas, just how bad is the health situation of the population? Do you see very visible signs of malnutrition, and I imagine especially amongst the children?
Indeed, and that is one of the most traumatic things. Everywhere we go, people being visibly undernourished, very thin, emaciated in some of the areas that are more cut off. The children, the acute malnutrition rates are very, very high.
Turning to the humanitarian workers themselves, people like you, who are often putting your lives on the line, going into conflict-ridden areas, what for you are the rewards of this job?
Oh, it is seeing the difference that our assistance makes when you go to somewhere. The simple gratitude of people who may have felt that the world had forgotten them. When you're able to go in, when you're able to deliver even the small things, bringing toys to children, bringing kids with things like soap, towels, the things that you and I might take for granted living in our own country. When you see the gratitude of people, so that for me is really what this is all about. It is that connection between one person and another person.
I was speaking there to Michael O'Riordan in South Sudan, a humanitarian official working for two Catholic aid agencies. This year, Rome and many other areas of Italy have received up to 80% less rain than average. And this unprecedented drought has prompted the Vatican to turn off its historic fountains in a bid to conserve water. But Rome is not normally a city that struggles with water shortages. And one of the key reasons for this is due to the actions of past popes. The constant flow of fresh water through the aqueducts and fountains of Rome has been a characteristic feature of the city since its earliest beginnings. In the torrid heat of the summer, Romans and tourists alike are grateful for the abundance of fresh water that flows from these fountains and the hundreds of simple street taps throughout the city. But how many people are aware that had it not been for the vision and generosity of a succession of past popes, hot and thirsty pilgrims may have found it much harder to find a ready source of refreshing water whilst exploring the Eternal City? I've been finding out more about the key role a number of these popes played, both in ensuring a plentiful supply of pure water to the populace and in commissioning some of the city's most famous and beautiful fountains. My interviewee is Elizabeth Lev, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University.
I think it's one of the most delightful things about Rome, the way that water is everywhere. Everywhere you turn, there's a water spigot or just a beautiful fountain. But that's part of Rome's history. And when the first Romans settled on those seven hills, half the reason was because it was riddled with underground springs. There would never be a lack of fresh water in the city.
And I gather that during the Roman Empire, there were no fewer than 12 aqueducts supplying water to some 1,300 fountains. That's a pretty amazing feat when you think how long ago it was and how few people there were living in the city compared to now.
As a matter of fact, the population of Rome under the empire had 1 million. Now Rome has something like 3 million, which it has to supply water to. But the water supply of Rome grew as Rome did. So Rome started out using its cisterns, underground springs, and of course the Tiber water. But by 312 BC, there wasn't enough water for the burgeoning city on the hills. So the first aqueduct was born, thanks to Appius Claudius, which brought water 10 kilometers into the city. And from then, it grew and grew and grew to end up with a colossal 12 aqueducts.
But then I gather that during the Dark Ages, all that fell into disrepair. And the city turned to using water from the Tiber.
Apparently, on page 2 or 3 of the Barbarian Siege Manual, it suggests to break the aqueducts, and the result of that was to push all the people on the hills back down towards the plain, where they could be close to the only source of water left, which was that of the Tiber.
And how long did they carry on using the water from the Tiber then?
They used it for almost 1,000 years, until the papacies of the Renaissance.
And it was Pope Sixtus IV, I gather, who reconditioned the Aqua Virgo Aqueduct in the late 1400s, and that was the start, wasn't it, of another sort of golden age as far as water is concerned.
Under many senses, Sixtus IV's pontificate was a golden age. The first man to span the Tiber with a bridge, the man who built the Sistine Chapel, and the man who repristined what was known as the best of all the aqueducts, the Aqua Virgo. Because the water from that aqueduct was always known to be the purest, the cleanest, the most limpid of all.
And I gather it's still in operation today, is that
right?
Oh,
yes it is. The Aqua Vergine is still working today.
But it wasn't just this pope, Pope Sixtus IV, who did all this work. I gather that the successive popes also, they created new aqueducts, they brought more water into the city, built fountains. Can you tell us something about particularly this building of the aqueduct?
Oh yes, not exactly coincidentally. The next great aqueduct building pope will be Pope Sixtus V, who is pope from 1585 to 1590. He built his own aqueduct known as the Aqua Felice, which means the happy aqueduct. But it actually refers to his first name, which was Felice. And he brought water in from the top of the Quirinal Hill and flooded the city, really revived the construction of the city so that the city would develop back along the Quirinal Hill.
And as far as we know, what prompted them to do this? I mean, was there a religious significance behind it, or was it really just an act of papal generosity?
Water to the city historically has always been connected with generosity. The Appius Claudius who offers this aqueduct, the Marcia family, which offers another aqueduct. The emperor who would build an aqueduct. But when the papacy started to rebuild and repristine these aqueducts, yes, it is, again, an act of great papal generosity. It's an act of reviving and rebuilding Rome. But I don't think you can separate this use of water, this flow of water through the city, from that sense of the call to conversion, the sense of baptism, the sense of renewal, all of these implications that water has.
What do you think was the most outstanding in terms of the engineering work concerned, or maybe just in the amount of water that it supplied, if you had to sort of look at all these projects and pinpoint one of them?
If we're talking about the ancient Rome, by the time the empire is underway, by the 2nd century AD, the aqueducts were bringing 1 million liters of water into Rome a day. It was an incredible flow of water through the city. But without the same economic resources that the imperial Rome had, without the same, even the manpower and slavery that ancient Rome had, without the same population and without the same ability to gather funds, papal Rome managed to repristine all of these aqueducts and bring back this water that would flow through the city. So it's interesting to see how the underdog, in a certain sense, which was papal Rome compared to imperial Rome, was able to recreate that great generosity of water. If it hadn't have been for these really visionary popes, they did many other things. They were concentrating on water, but these popes also had a great vision of creating out of Rome the center of the church, a place where people would come from lands and cities where there isn't much water, or where there wouldn't be bridges, or it wouldn't be so well set out and laid out as a city. And you would come to Rome and you would see through the flow of the water, through the organization of the roads, through the well-constructed city, you would see the greatness of the heart of Christendom.
Now, a lot of this water was going to feed the fountains, and of course Rome is world famous for its fountains. How instrumental was the role of the papacy here in commissioning these fountains throughout the centuries?
There are 1,500 ornamental fountains in one way or another in Rome. About three quarters of them were built by the papacy. The popes created the particularly beautiful fountains are what is known as a show, and it's when the aqueduct first brings the water into the city. It's the moment that the water first emerges from the aqueduct and flows into its first fountain. And the shows are the ones that you know, the people know best. The Trevi Fountain is the show for the Aqua Vergine. The Moses Fountain on the top of the Quirinal Hill is the show for the Aqua Felice. And so they created these very big, beautiful fountains to celebrate the arrival of the water into the city. And then they were responsible for the cute little decorative fountains that would be in a corner of one street or tucked away into a piazza.
So let's take some of these famous fountains. The Moses Fountain, for instance, what Pope helped?
It was Sixtus V who ordered the construction of the Moses Fountain, and it's designed in the form of a triumphal arch. There are three arches, so again, the triumph of water, the arrival of water as it first emerges from the aqueduct. And the image shows Moses striking the rock for the water to leap forth, and then next to him there are these supplementary images of Aaron, the chief priest, and the people waiting for the water. And it's decorated in the front with four basalt lions, which were at once upon a time, Egyptian lions, which are now in the Vatican Museums, but at the time they were lions that had been brought in from Egypt. And it makes a very kind of dramatic sense of triumph, which is a big part of this pontificate.
Now, of course, for most tourists, the Trevi Fountain is the most famous for a number of reasons. Can you tell us something about the papal role here?
Well, the Trevi Fountain starts as an ancient Roman aqueduct, is the show for the Aqua Vergine, which was built by the son-in-law and designated heir of Augustus, who was Agrippa in 25 BC. Now, that aqueduct, like all the others, fell into disuse, but it was legendary for the sweetness and the purity of its water. In the 1640s, Pope Urban VIII had the idea of getting people to move back onto the Quirinal Hill, moving away from the overcrowded area near the river. And he saw that Sixtus IV had already repristined the aqueduct. Water was already flowing into that area. But to create a kind of draw, he projected a very grand fountain for that show. And he started out by hiring none other than Gian Lorenzo Bernini. And Gian Lorenzo Bernini began by designing the square, not the fountain, so that the first thing that we all remember about the Trevi is the way we happened on it by surprise. I think everyone who's seen the Trevi Fountain remembers being kind of wandering through streets, wondering where this fountain is, and then the shock and surprise of encountering the fountain. And that was the work of Bernini. Now, the project then lay unattended to for almost 100 years. And it was just let go because it was too expensive, because it was too complicated, because there wasn't much interest. But between 1730 and 1740, the Corsini Pope decided to call up a contest to see who could come up with the best design. And Niccolo Salvi won the contest for designing the Trevi Fountain. Poor Niccolo Salvi didn't even live to see his fountain completed. It wasn't done until Benedict XIV's reign in 1762.
And Piazza Navona, of course, the Four Rivers fountain there. Is there a papal link to this as well?
Well, that fountain is one of the most famous papal fountains of all. That fountain is, for art historians, it's the fountain that got Bernini back into papal graces, because there had been a big blow-up between Pope Innocent X and the artist Bernini in 1644, basically. Over the facade of St. Peter's, they were constructing a bell tower, and Bernini was in charge of the construction, and a crack formed in the facade of St. Peter's, and Innocent X, of course, was infuriated. There were a number of Bernini detractors who were ready to whisper in the ear of Innocent X, and Bernini had been sent away in disgrace from papal court. Now, in 1650, Innocent X wanted to build a fountain for what was essentially his front yard. The Pamphili Palace is the palace on the Piazza Navona that looks out over the Four Rivers Fountain. And he wanted a fountain that would combine an obelisk with this ancient Egyptian monument that were beginning to pop up all over the city. But at the same time, he wanted to bring water to the piazza out of that same generous appearance of the papacy. But everybody who presented projects to him presented the same thing, sort of an obelisk, a trough, the water. It wasn't very exciting. And the Pope was dissatisfied. Well, Bernini made a sterling silver model of the fountain that you see today, and he had it left in the Pope's apartments. And when the Pope came in and saw that model of the fountain, he said, "This is my fountain. This is the one. Who made it?" And when he heard that the artist was Bernini, he said, "Those who would not use the works of Bernini had better not look at them." And so Bernini was back in papal graces and constructing that wonderful fountain of the Four Rivers.
Elizabeth Leff, Professor of Christian Art and Architecture in Rome. And that's all we have time for in today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.